The next speaker is one of the most admirable men that I have ever known, and definitely one of the most respected. He's respected and admired by his friends, and he's respected and feared by those people who would argue against his propositions. To speak to you on the League of Rights, the National Party, and the rural disaster, may I introduce Mr. Jeremy Lee.
Well, Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen, Dr. John Kingston was supposed to be on now, and I was going to come after him. Now, I don't know what the story is. There was a lot of pressure on John Kingston not to come, but he didn't flinch at all. I have no problem speaking on a League platform, but his wife was taken very ill, and we'd booked him in last night into the motel in Crow's Nest, and I got a message from his office to say that because his wife was sick, he was going to try and drive down today and then just speak for an hour and then go back again. And he's obviously running a bit late, so I just hope nothing has happened. But with any luck, he'll be here after I've finished. And he does deserve a bit of support, because he's the only politician who's dared to come. There are a number asked to come and speak at this seminar, including a former Premier of Queensland, I might add, who told us he was sympathetic, but he decided, because he was retired, he'd sooner stay out of it now. So the heat is on, and men like John Kingston are pretty rare. He's not a natural politician. He's a very quiet man. He's a very studious man. But if he does make it, let's give him a good welcome when he does come. I think he will be here, but he's just not made it yet. My job is to try and give you a bit of background to all this nonsense that's going on between Pauline Hanson and Graham Campbell, and what it's about and the background to that. And that means that I'm going to deal with some of the history of what happened in the League and in the rural areas during the 70s and 80s. And quite a lot of people now don't know that story, although it was vivid and real enough to those who were involved at that particular time. And there are people here who went through what was really, it was the blowtorch. And I think of men like Keith Fuss and Alan Ellis and the Smiths and others. It was a very, very intense period. And I think perhaps the best thing I can do is to tell you some of the background to that and to how we've arrived at this situation. The League of Rights has been turned from reality, which is a fairly small organization in terms of what happens in Australia, of conservative people, many of whom were servicemen, a lot of people who won medals during the last war and served their country. It's been turned by very, very careful engineering into the dead opposite of what it is, and it's just now a mythological monster that is used to frighten political children, and the media is a large part of that. And so the stuff you're reading from Ron Boswell and from Pauline Hanson has got no bearing on reality at all. We need to have a look at some of that picture. I want to tell you that, as a background, it is true that while you can get great industrial nations, and you can get nations with very sophisticated mercantile systems, and you can get a great deal of trade, and you can get magnificent buildings, and you can have great technology, there is no such thing as a successful civilized society that is able to exist without a strong rural base. And it is a great network, a hinterland of small farmers, and the townships that feed those farmers, and the little industries that provide for them, on which really the whole of the rest depends. And this has been understood time and time again. And every time people have tried to wipe out their farming communities, they've ended up destroying their societies. It's happened so clearly, so often. It happened in the Greek civilization. And if you care to do it, you can go back and have a look through Encyclopedia Britannica, and you can see how they wiped out the whole farming community at one stage in Greece. This is 500 years before Christ. And all the little villagers, and they were threatened with being driven off the land. And finally, a great appeal was made to one of the great philosophers in Greece by the name of Solon, what was to be done to save that Greek civilization. And he said, the only possible thing you can do is to wipe the debts. And if you do that, there's a chance of coming through. And they actually wiped the whole debt in Greece. So we're talking about 500 years before Christ. And they managed to avert the collapse of that civilization. And then the next great one that came was Rome. And there's a great mass of stuff on what happened in the final stages of Rome, where thousands and thousands of small farmers were driven off the land. And it was done not at the point of a spear or a gun. It was simply by jacking their taxes up and getting them so deeply in debt that they couldn't survive. And they became, as they were driven off and all the little townships collapsed, they became the great unemployed masses in the streets of Rome and other areas of Italy, and they had to be entertained, and they were fed with the bread and circuses, and they actually had what we've got now. They had a perverted form of the dole, and instead of actually giving you a dole check, that you had to gather once or twice a week at certain points in the city, and they gave you free bread and free wine. And those great masses of shiftless people who'd lost their roots and their homes became very, very restive, and they had to be kept entertained, and they put on the bread and circuses, all that stuff. So there's nothing new under the sun, and we're now making the same mistake. We're believing that we can successfully eradicate the small farmer who is the custodian, not only of food production, but also, believe it or not, of true conservation. You cannot have good land conservation without small farmers. And even if you've got small farmers, you can't have good conservation unless they are well enough off not only to produce, but also to preserve. And you get books like The Evolution of the English Farm, and food production was secondary to the main purpose of what they were about. It was, if you like, a creed, an ethos amongst British farmers for about 1,200 years that you always tried to pass your farm on in a more fertile and productive situation than when you first got it from your parents. And it was an institution. It was as deeply embedded in the roots of the family as the family itself. And all that now is expendable, and we've got this strange thing called competition and production and efficiency, and the last thing that is considered is the care of the land or the care of the rivers or the care of the forests. And so even though we can decry the conservationists, they have got a case. They're not always right. They're exploited. They're financed by the wrong people. They're often idealistic. But it is true we're wrecking the Murray River. And it is true that we've got a huge salinity problem. And my own belief is that we're not going to solve that in the end. We can have all the government schemes in the world you like, but we're not going to solve that till we get small farmers back in a profit situation where they are the state of their farm is of even greater importance than the state of their bank balance. And when we do that, then we're going to start growing again. But at the moment, we're dying. And we're dying so fast that my belief is the impossible could happen. And the impossible is that we're going to move from a world of massive food overproduction to shortages of food. And in areas, you can see that. I don't know whether you know it, but we're actually landing milk from New Zealand in this country now. It is being flown into Townsville. Some of you may know these things. I saw a picture just the other day of what is happening to English farming. They have wiped out much of their meat industry. They now import 500,000 tons of pork every year into Britain, and they used to be self-sufficient. They've wiped out the beef industry, and they import about the same amount of beef. They have destroyed half their fruit orchards in Britain now under the name of rationalization and efficiency. And the consequence is that England, the home of the apple, is now importing 400,000 tons of apples every year. Now, what is happening in England, which is a movement towards scarcity of food and the destruction of good food, is going to spread rapidly right throughout the world if we don't do something to at least try and keep the few pitiful numbers of farmers that we've got left. So that's simply a background to what I want to say, but we had last night our 35th dinner here in Queensland. The first one was in 1967, and that was the year that I started as a rather idealistic young person with the bloom of youth on my cheeks and all the rest of it, as a full-time speaker. And I must admit that I was more of a menace than a help. I had not really understood social credit. I was driven, I suppose, by a fear of what had happened in Africa. I'd only just arrived in Australia. I was beginning to try and learn the local language, and that's very difficult if you don't come from Australia. strange phrases come pouring out. And I didn't know what half of it meant. I mean, what is genuinely, if you're a foreigner in this country, what is a bonza sheila? And what is a fair cow? And is a fair cow and a bonza sheila the same thing? And who's to know what the answer to those questions is? And then I heard, my mother was very English, and she came in one day and she said she'd just heard, she was white in the face, her neighbour had been in bed with a wog. And it conjured up shocking pictures of this strange land we'd come to. And it took me some time to realise how lucky I was that we'd come to Australia and what a tremendous country this is and what a tremendous resilience and health there is here. And so I started lecturing, and strangely enough at that time, almost as I started, we had a huge rural crisis. We'd lost between 1965 and 1970 30,000 farmers. But we still had damn near a quarter of the farmers left, and so I find myself as one of a number of speakers going out night after night after night and speaking to strange places, Thargaminda and Cloncurry and St. George's. Who's heard of St. George? We used to have great meetings down at St. George. And we were running about 200 meetings a year at that stage. And it was, you know, and we put out into circulation a little book called They Want Your Land. Does anybody here remember They Want Your Land? Thousands and thousands of copies. It was just a little book that there was a long-term plan to exchange family farming for corporate farming. And this had come out in documents produced by Political and Economic Planning in Britain, and they said, we don't need small farmers anymore, let's get rid of them and we'll have giant cartels. That's the way to run the place. And I remember great debates. We had a professor in Western Australia by the name of Henry Schapper who attacked that little book on the ABC Rural Hour. And there were dinosaurs going around trying to frighten the farmers and all this sort of stuff. And the meetings were getting bigger and bigger. And the theme of this book that we put out was that the key to successful preservation of farmers here in Australia was to have long-term, low-interest finance, and that you couldn't go charging farmers 5 and 6 and 7 and 8%. And that sounds low today. 4% was a very high interest rate when I first came out here. And I remember protests in Australia that interest rates had gone up to 4%. And they'd done a study in Denmark, and they had come out with a very good report which said that because of nature and because of the nature of farming and the fact that seasons are variable, you cannot preserve a farming community if you're going to charge them more than 4%. One of the key planks of the country party was then, was you've got to have long-term, low-interest finance, and you've got to have stabilized costs. You cannot put farmers in a situation where their incomes are there and costs keep going up and up and up and up and up, because sooner or later you will eradicate. And they produced a slogan, which was parodied by Doug Anthony, Get Big or Get Out, which was a description not of a policy but of a failure. So it got very intense, and I've got to be honest, the whole farming world, the agricultural world here in Australia, was in ferment, and huge meetings were held. We've got to do something about this. We cannot keep losing farmers at the rate we're losing them. And the Country Party was quite interested in what was going on, and they had to be, because they were getting hammered by their members. And every Country Party meeting, as it was then, and national Queensland Graziers Associations and all the rest were full of people saying, look, why don't we get our old policy? Long-term, low-interest farmers to preserve the farming community. And the Country Party was in a very difficult situation. How did they deal with this? They knew that the League of Rights was pushing this stuff out. They knew that the League of Rights was explaining to people what was going on. And they knew that they had to come up with some answers. So they went through the motions. And the motions were that, all right, we're listening. Have you ever heard that one before? And they called, I just want to tell you some of the personal experiences. They called a special one-day-long conference here in Queensland at the end of the 1969 to discuss how we were going to save the family farm. And I was personally sent a letter by Sir Robert Sparks. Would I turn up and provide evidence? And there would be two other speakers, and they would get each one to speak, and then there would be questions and answers, and I was only too happy to do that. We turned up at a hotel in Brisbane, and the other two were a guy called Jensen, who was an absolute disaster, And Jensen from Queensland University said we had far too many farmers and we had to wind the rural community down to 5% of the community. Came out to the Country Party and told them this is the policy you should follow. And even they thought that was a bit much. And then they had an old economist called H.W. Herbert, who used to write for the Sunday Mail, and some of you would remember him, who was pretty sensible. And yes, we could do a lot to save the family farm. And he agreed long-term low-interest finance was the answer. But how do you do it? So then they get Jeremy Lee. And I was young and raw at that stage. And I said I didn't believe it could be done unless we were prepared to use the Commonwealth Bank and the National Credit, which we had done during the war and we'd done during the First World War, and if the Country Party had the courage, it should do this. But to my amazement, about 11 o'clock, somebody in the management committee, and there were about 30 or 40 there, got up and really built it into me. Ladies and gentlemen, this is that queer, crazy social credit nonsense. This is funny money. And if we start looking at this stuff, we might as well give the game away. And I suggest that Mr. Lee be asked to leave at this moment. And it was on for young and old. And I got very heated and I got up and told him he was whatever it was. And we shouted at each other and I quoted out of the Country Party policy and they poo-pooed that and finally got so hot that Sir Robert Sparks, who was chairing the thing, had to call time out and said we'd have lunch break. So everybody breathes a sigh of relief and away they go to get their sandwiches and goodness knows what, except for this guy who'd attacked me. And we were the last two in that room. And he came over to me and said, come and have a beer. We walked out across George Street to the hotel opposite and sat down at the bar and he said, of course, you're absolutely right. But he said, you know bloody well we can't touch that stuff. Look at the overdraft our party's got for a start. We'd get no more finance, the media would be against us, and we wouldn't get back in office. Now, he was the Federal Minister for Agriculture, and his name was Charlie Adaman. Not only was he Charlie Adaman, but he was a lifelong member of the Country Party, and every Sunday he gave a half-hour Sunday school program over Radio Kingroy on how all young children should be honest and always talk the truth. He did that for 60 years. I nearly fell off the bar stool. Couldn't drink my beer. We go back in after that intimate conversation, back into the Country Party Management Committee hearing at 2 o'clock, and lo and behold, he gets up and attacks me again. Let's have an end to this funny money stuff. He then got his knighthood, retired from politics, and we were producing in Queensland at that stage a newspaper called Queensland Calling. Does anybody remember Queensland Calling? The editor was a very well-known builder in Dalby by the name of Hilton Redding, who is now running a radio station down on the Gold Coast. Tremendous bloke. So Charlie Adaman, once he had retired from politics, became the patron of that paper, and used to contribute articles on the finance question. Now that's what we're dealing with. We're not dealing with a matter of truth or logic or common sense. We're dealing with power. And they, while he was in office and he was a politician, even though he knew what we were saying was the truth, he was not prepared to stand up for it. And there is no way you can fight that through conventional means. So here was the Country Party caught in a terrible situation. Thousands of farmers were being driven off the land. There's a strange movement called the League of Rights, which was not putting up candidates, going around simply having education. This is why it's happening, and that's what could solve it. They'd asked us to come and give evidence. All that was recorded. I've got all the documents from that thing, including a letter of thanks from Bob Sparks for turning up. And either the Country Party had to do what had to be done, or they had to find a way to get themselves off the hook. And so, all of a sudden, an attack was launched on the League of Rights that we were a pro-Nazi organization and we were trying to cause disaffection and disabuse in the bush. And it was on for young and old. And they sent out, the headquarters of the Country Party were denying they'd said that, but they were sending in secret this document out to all their branches. And so we ended up, through the League of Rights, through Eric Butler, challenging them to either put up or shut up, and it ended up in a debate of over 1,000 people out in Dalby at the RSL. And there'd be one or two people here would remember that, Heath. We had a guy was prepared to get up and give evidence that the League of Rights not only were all Nazis, but that we were actually having secret midnight meetings out on the downs with white suits on and conical hats. And by the time Eric had answered that, two things had happened. Doug Anthony had attacked us down south, and the pressure in Queensland was so great that, to its credit, the Country Party up here in Queensland publicly disassociated itself from the attack that the League of Rights was pro-Nazi. And the issue was put out, a statement was put out in the papers and was carried in the Courier Mail. Sir Robert Sparks successfully moves that the Country Party in Queensland disassociate itself from the accusation the League of Rights is pro-Nazi. At the debate in Dalby, we had two prominent leaders. We had Bob Sparks, the president of the Country Party, and we had Les Price, who was the head of the grain growers. And Bob Sparks used that occasion to make a public appeal to 1,000 people through Eric Butler, who was on the stage debating the issue: would you please urge all your League of Rights supporters to rally round the Country Party because we need a voice in the rural areas to protect the farmers? That was his public appeal. To which Eric replied, we're prepared to support you if you support the farmers. Just get back to your old policies and we'll support you. We don't want to attack you. We're not attacking personalities. We're attacking this evil that is destroying rural Australia. So Bob Sparks then put out two full pages in the Queensland Country Life, setting out what the Country Party stood for and suggesting that it was a great tragedy the League of Rights was attacking the Country Party and appealing for support. And in the course of that, he said, we are prepared to put forward a proposition which could save the farming areas. And I want to read what he put in this article. Because of the great importance of maintaining viable primary industries in Australia, the federal government should provide a source of long-term fixed contract interest rate finance below 3% to individual primary producers adversely affected by drought, low prices, and rising costs. As the leader of the management committee of the Queensland Country Party, we are now advocating long-term, low-interest finance, fixed contract, cannot be changed, below 3%, and that's the way to save the farmers. And if the Country Party had done that, and if they had said to the Liberals, this is so important that we are prepared to break the coalition sooner than sacrifice farmers, we would not have a rural crisis today. Not only that, but I believe the League of Rights would have swung in behind the Country Party and said, so long as you stick to that policy, we'll stick behind you and we'll try and get as much support behind you as possible. 2 weeks later, after Sir Robert Sparks had put in his two pages, through the efforts of hundreds and hundreds of farmers who contributed a few bucks, the League of Rights put in a full-page reply to Bob Sparks. And I was the guy who wrote that, and I had my photo. I was very good looking in those days. It was really terrific. I had hair and all those strange things. And we simply set out, this is the program that has been designed to get rid of the farmers in Australia, and those are the policies that are needed to save the farmers. And if you don't grasp the nettle, there's coming a time when we'll have hardly any farmers left in Australia. And it's up to you whether you're going to do this or not. So the Country Party had reached a watershed, and they either had to do the right thing or they had to get some. So all they did was secretly expand the attack on the League. And it was Nazi, and it was anti-Semitic, and it was this, and it was that, and it was really trying to take over, and it was actually had a secret agenda to break democracy in Australia. And it's amazing, once you spread that stuff, how widely it goes, and all the old blue bloods in the Country Party and the graziers said, well, of course, you know, they do talk a lot of sense of League of Rights, but you can't afford to be seen with them. And they used to scurry out whenever we had meetings, and the number of farmers leaving the land just went on by thousands and thousands every year. And we have gone from over 300,000 farmers at the end of the war down to, what have we got now? 85,000 farmers left, and they're going off now faster than ever before in our history. And we have wrecked huge areas of Australia, denuded them of the people, wrecked families, destroyed the lives of kids, left towns abandoned, and pushed more and more people into the cities. It wasn't very long after that that we thought we had the chance of a breakthrough with a very good, bold Queensland Premier by the name of Joe Jelke-Peterson. And Joe Jelke-Peterson was prepared to say the right things. Whatever else is said about Joe, if he thought something was right, he stuck to it. And Joe Jelke-Peterson put forward during the time of Gough Whitlam in 1974 a program that could have changed Australia. It was called the Peterson Plan. Anybody remember the Peterson Plan? First thing is, if you want to drop prices, wipe out sales tax. Simple common sense. And two, let's go back and have a look at the war and use the old price subsidy mechanism to stabilize the cost of basic items. And if they'd done that, we'd have been a long way ahead. The third thing was, he was prepared to start a state bank here in Queensland under the Constitution, Section 51, where Canberra is not allowed to control state banks so long as you don't go outside the borders of the state. When Joe Jelke put forward the idea of a state bank in Queensland to help primary producers, it was as though the whole world had fallen on him. And in private talks with him, and I had a relationship in which I could talk to him, and he used to tell me some of the things that were happening. He said the weight that went on me within the country party not to produce a state bank was such that I could not prevail. And it is also true that a number of top international financiers flew out to Australia, including a gentleman by the name of Henry Kissinger, and they had a private conference with Joe and advised him he was not to go that way. Now, that is how hot some of these things are. And so from there on, the relationship between the Country Party and the League of Rights deteriorated rapidly. In one of the last elections to get Joe in, we had a visit, and the man who could tell you more about this than anybody else is Chas Pinwell. We had one of their senators came and asked, would we man the booths of the Country Party, because they couldn't man them themselves. And that was a guy by the name of Ron Boswell. And by that time we were pretty sick, and Chas Pinwell attacked Ron Boswell and pointed out, after Ron Boswell had attacked us in Parliament, that he'd actually come and asked us to man the voting booths at one stage. And so Ron Boswell has been used as a bagman to try and paint the League of Rights as a group of jackboot Nazis ever since. And that is the background to what is happening at the time. And gradually they've built up the pressure until good men and good women are now too petrified to come and speak on a League platform, even if they know it's right. And it's only a certain type of individual that's prepared to do that. And I've got to dip my lid to Selwyn Johnson for coming here today. And I know that Selwyn Johnson was under pressure not to come. And I know that other politicians were under pressure not to come. And there are some who just get right under the table if you only mention the name League of Rights at the present time. And one of those who has really stuck his neck out, of course, is Graham Campbell. And Graham Campbell has spoken on a number of League platforms, which is not to be taken as saying that he endorses everything the League stands for. I don't think he knows necessarily everything we stand for. I don't think it is doing him an injustice to say that I don't think he knows terribly much about social credit. But he's an honest man and he's a courageous man. And one of the reasons why the whole media went silent on Graham Campbell at the time that Pauline Hanson was coming up to the top was because he was prepared to speak on League platforms and they didn't want any of that sort of stuff. And so they put all the publicity, and there's no such thing as bad publicity, behind Pauline Hanson. And that's why at the present time, all of a sudden, where it looked as though resurrected one nation, which has been through hell, and if you look at what has been done to one nation, whatever side of politics you're on, it's quite disgusting. Even when she was an independent and she got in, long before One Nation was formed, they took all the money away from her because they hadn't had time to change the ballot slips and she still appeared as a Liberal. So the money that Pauline Hanson won legitimately by winning that election went to the Liberal Party. It's stinking stuff. And they then took them through court and they then ridiculed her, and then they finally went through the violent confrontations and the thuggery at her meetings and all that stuff. And whatever else you say about Pauline Hanson, she's not the wisest woman. She's got a lot of guts. And she's stood up tremendously. And the only thing I think is a pity is that she now has an ego problem, which is such that she can't countenance any other form of advice other than her own. And so into this situation, which has finally reached a situation where the great revolt in Australia against the parties is now reaching such an intensity, it's got both the Labour and the Liberals and the National Party absolutely petrified. And there's no doubt that One Nation has made a dramatic comeback, both in Western Australia and in Queensland. And finally, the news came just the other day that Graham Campbell was prepared to, join One Nation and forget about Australia First. And that presented us with a greater hope, I think, than anything we'd had for a very long time. Because if you could got the fire and determination and courage of Pauline Hanson and the wisdom and the knowledge and, incidentally, the courage of Graham Campbell, you could have welded a force here in Australia, both with the integrity and the policies, to really force a dramatic change. And who should come into this wallowing like a great cane toad but Senator, the grim weeper, Ron Boswell. And he does it quite simply. This means the League of Rights is taking over One Nation. And out it comes with a great statement in the papers, and if you're going to join One Nation, you're going to have to run the gauntlet of the League of Rights, and you're going to have to deny the Holocaust occurred, and you're going to have to deny that Jesus Christ was a Jew. All this written up in The Australian. It was pathetic stuff. I mean, the League of Rights doesn't take a stand on any of those issues. Some of the people in it have very strong personal opinions one way or the other. You wouldn't get agreement on every issue. I've had hot arguments with people in the League of Rights about some of those issues. But that's not part of the policy of the movement. The policy of the movement is quite simply that we are a Christian-based movement. We stand for small government, decentralized government, preservation of the Constitution, the rule of law, and private property. Only the National Party would do the same thing. We'd have a hope. So there it was, and they put the heat on Graham Campbell first of all, and he said he was damned if he was going to repudiate the League of Rights. He didn't necessarily endorse them, but he was jolly well going to speak on any platform that he wanted. And this did not mean he was for them or against them, but as far as he was concerned, he couldn't see anything wrong with the League. They stood for God, Queen, and Country. That was a bit odd in this day and age, but that's how he saw them. And had they both taken that line, the whole thing would have blown over, and Ron Boswell would have sunk back into, under his, whatever it is he comes from, and that would have been the end of it. But I'm sad to say that Pauline Hanson has now demanded that either Graham goes or she goes. And the issue is the League of Rights. If he's not prepared to repudiate the League of Rights, well, then she's probably thinking of pulling out of One Nation and standing as an independent. And it's almost as though the League of Rights had become a great big black cloud, and everybody's either got to stand up and look at it or bow down. But and we've got nothing to do with either One Nation or Graham Campbell or anything else, other than we're prepared to provide a platform for the whole lot. So I don't know what's going to happen. And I know that there is a big movement in One Nation who thinks that it would be a major advantage to get Graham Campbell back. Whatever finally transpires, it's not the making of the League of Rights at all. League of Rights, as Betty Luke said that last night, has recently withdrawn the invitation to Graham Campbell to come and speak. He was scheduled to speak in one of our platforms in Sydney in the middle of June, and not because we are against him at all, but simply it might make life a bit more bearable. But I'll tell you this, from here on until the next election, we're going to have The Australian and the Rupert Murdoch Press and everything else hammering this issue. The League of Rights is now running the backlash. And Ron Boswell will be the bloated weapon they're going to try and use to make everybody frightened and get undercover and all of us go back and vote for the National Party. Nobody's going to vote for the National Party again, I'll tell you. I mean, they're dead men walking now, as far as I can see. They've never stood for the country yet. The epitaph to the Country Party and the National Party is what has happened in rural Australia. We've gone from over 300,000 farmers to about 85 to 90, and they're still leaving. The epitaph to the Country Party is all the empty country towns. The epitaph to the Country Party is the broken marriages and the destroyed hopes of young Australians. They daren't face the issue of sovereignty in Australia. They daren't issue they daren't face the issue of private poverty. They daren't take on this water control that Selwyn Johnson was pointing out. They daren't stand for anything they traditionally stood for. The Country Party and the National Party daren't even come out now for long-term, low-interest finance for farmers, which used to be the number one policy they stood on. They daren't even say it. And they have reached the stage now, they are so despicable that they are prepared to allow another 50,000 farmers to go, so long as we all vote for them and give them their superannuation and their big holidays and allow them to come to the few remaining country shows and stride around in their elastic-sided boots and their Stetsons and tell us what jolly good chaps they are. And they've reached the end of the road. Got nothing to do with the League of Rights at all. The League of Rights disappeared off the face of the earth tomorrow, it would make a scrap of difference as far as the future of the National Party is concerned. They have shot themselves right through the heart. And it's a tragedy, because if ever there was a people who deserve better representation, it is country people. They have been shot and betrayed at every turn. And the only thing you can say that they haven't done is that they themselves have not demanded what they should have demanded. But that's where we are at the present time. But I want you to think, as I finish, of one last thing that I think is important. We've reached a stage now, here in Australia, where people are genuinely frightened to go to certain meetings. It wouldn't matter if you had the Archangel Gabriel standing where I'm standing now. If it was a League of Rights seminar, three-quarters of the people would not dare come. Now, that is a situation that has never happened in Australia before. We used to have an attitude, you could go and listen to the Communist Party, didn't mean you agreed with them. You can go and argue with the Fabians, because we were a free society and we said and thought what we believe. And when you can produce a situation in a country where people are frightened to be politically incorrect and are frightened to go and listen to a speaker because of the associations that somebody suggested were attached to him, we have become a Big Brother state. Without even analyzing it, we have lost our independence. And the one thing each person here has got to do is to make up your mind on this. Am I a free person? If I am a free person, have I got the courage to stand for the things that are unpopular and to go and listen to the speakers who are not politically correct? Because I believe those are the things you should do in a free country. And if you've got any question mark over those issues in your mind, you ought to go back and re-examine your position, because we're going to need people. And I don't care where they come from, what church they go to, what state they live in, whether they're men or women. We want people who, above all, are true to themselves. And they are prepared to stand for what they believe, whether it's unpopular or not. And if you find yourself getting intimidated, then you're losing. Because the battle in Australia is about sovereignty. Not so much the sovereignty of the nation, although that is important, but the sovereignty of you as a person. That little thing that is God-given inside you that says, I am a free and responsible human being. And it is that thing which distinguished Australia from so many countries in the past. And in the meetings of young people that I've been speaking to recently, I've tried to tell them about that. The issue that you have to face is whether you can listen to any opinion and make your own judgment, or whether you're going to have that done for you by the state. And I always end up by telling them, and I think this is beginning to get through because there is a change, I tell them about the Australia of their fathers and their grandfathers. I used to do a seminar called Freedom Potentials, and one of the things I did in that seminar was to play a tape, which is one of the most precious things I've got. And it's a tape done by four men who came back from Changi. And it's a harrowing story. They went through absolute hell. But do you know, the survival rate amongst the Australian people in Changi was higher than any other race. Not because they're physically stronger, but because they had a very fierce, deep loyalty to each other. They clung to each other. They protected each other. They sacrificed for each other. And if one person had been brutally beaten or was sick of some terrible disease, the others would gladly sacrifice that little bit of rice that kept them alive in order to get their mate through. And the result was we had a higher survival rate in that camp. And these men tell their story of how they were forced to work 16 hours a day and under the most appalling, brutal conditions. And then in this camp, on Sunday evenings, they got just enough time to go up a hill, One Tree Hill in the middle of the camp, and they used to have a church service there on Sunday evenings. And he said these men would crawl up, dragging their crutches behind them in some cases. And they would listen to the sermon, and they went just peaceful Sunday congregations like we have today. They were fiercely critical. And the pastor, who was a very strong man himself, used to get hammered by his congregation. Now look, pastor, you tell us that the Christian faith says we have to love our enemies and do good to those that hurt us. How do we love these bastards who are beating us up? And the pastor used to say, I didn't know how to answer that. I was faced, because I hated the buggers too. I'd seen the terrible things they'd done, smashing people to death. And he said, I don't know how to answer that, but I do know this, you cannot hold hatred within you. Somehow you've got to deal with it. It might take you a bit of time, but the difference between our faith and the others is that we are prepared to give that up in the end. And they could see that. They could agree with that. And he said, we used to have our services, and then as the sun went down, and they would sit and talk about what they were going through, he said that always as the sun came down, he said, there'd be a silence come over all those men. And he said, I saw them all looking south. And I knew they were looking at Australia. And they were thinking of a little hut tucked into the Darling Ranges, or a girlfriend, or a couple of kids, or a horse, and above all, a free country. There's another story which is even more dramatic about a group of women who were in a refugee camp in Sumatra. They couldn't even speak to each other. There were so many races, they hadn't got a common language. And one unassuming Australian woman brought them all together. I picture her in my mind like Wendy Skur, that type of woman, you know, the very essence of strength and compassion. And she used to make them, even after 16 hours work a day, she used to make them sit round a campfire and sing their songs. And she said, after about a year, we ran out of songs. So she actually rewrote from memory the great operas and the great oratorios and songs, and she was a musician. And she divided the audience into a human orchestra, and one group of women were flutes, and one group of women were cellos, and one group of women were violins. And she made them practice their musical parts. And finally, one day, the sound of a human orchestra went up from that camp. It was a statement of rebellion. It was a statement of faith. And the Japanese commandant, who was over 6 foot, which is very unusual, came roaring down from his office to smash these women back into the dust. And he came in, and he was overwhelmed by the sound he heard. It was angelic. And he stopped and he stood and he didn't know whether to go forward or back. And finally, he bowed to those women and he backed out and he left. A third of the Australian women in that camp died.
Please stop the tape and turn to side two.
A third of the Australian women in that camp died. And when the war was over, they put a concert on in Adelaide, and the remnants repeated the human orchestra. And the whole of Adelaide was there. And the whole of Adelaide in that audience were in tears. And do you know, none of those kids have heard that story. They made a film of it now, Paradise Road. I don't know if it's a brilliant film, but it's a poignant story. That should be cut into the hearts of every Australian. And they were not frightened to believe or to speak. And they were the ones who passed freedom on to us. And they're the ones that we must honor in the fight to keep our personal integrity and freedom in this country. And that is what the National Party and the politicians have betrayed. And it's groups like you and I who've got to preserve what flame there is left and carry it forward. And everybody here is very important. Some of you say, I don't know what I can do. But if you just stand to your beliefs, you've done something. And if you just honor the source of your beliefs, you're on the right side. And if you don't give up on Australia, we're going to win. Thank you very much. Bob Katter is a brilliant exponent of what ought to be done, but he never actually does it. He always says the right things, but if you look at his voting record, and that's the test, he never quite gets as far as voting that way. And I think the same is true of Deanne Kelly. And if she had the time, Betty could tell you of a meeting where she shared the platform. I bet Deanne Kelly wouldn't like to know that she'd shared a platform with the League of Rights Speaker just at the moment. But she and Betty spoke together on the same platform. And apparently Deanne Kelly made a brilliant speech about one of the evils sweeping, whether it was the national competition policy or whatever it happened to be. But somebody in the audience made this mistake of saying to Betty, when Betty got up and speak, well, how did Deanne Kelly vote on that one? GST, was it? And Betty said, well, look, the lady is here. Why didn't you ask her? So they asked Deanne Kelly, who'd spoken against the GST, how did you actually vote on it? And she'd voted for it, of course. She must have lost a lot of votes that night. The test is not what they say, it's what they do. Now, it may be that in the final analysis, Bob Katter does take the plunge and take a stand. I don't know. I mean, who can judge anybody in the end? We've seen people compromise a long way down the track, but there finally comes a point where they've got to take a stand. Perhaps that's the time that is approaching for Bob Katter, but he hasn't done it yet. Any more? Perhaps I could tell you that at the time all that furphy was going on with the Country Party back in the early 70s, the Labour Party was preparing its rural platform. And it was a brilliant platform. We are losing too many farmers. We've got to do something. The answer is to cut interest rates. And we think the crisis is so great we should actually have a 5-year holiday period for farmers where they don't have to repay debt or interest. That's the only way we've got of turning the thing around. And they went further. We're going to use the Commonwealth Bank to do it. And when they actually got into office, it was just thrown out of the window. So they're the greatest betrayers. They're the people who brought the Commonwealth Bank in, and they've sold the damn thing. Yes, you're right. I mean, but my own feeling is, Bill, that an awful lot of people have picked Kim Beazley. He's not nearly as good as Beattie, and he doesn't come over as well. I think Beattie, in his own way, the thing that got him through, he's essentially fairly honest. But I don't think Kim Beazley is. And the polls seem to show that the greatest, there's a lot of people who don't like him. I think the decisive factor is going to be, in the end, not fought in the party game. I think it's going to be over a single issue, which is whether we buy Australia back or not, and whether we stop this foreign takeover. And so all these other movements, you don't see them as having anything to do with the electoral process. But blokes like Dick Smith and John Pym and the Ausbuy Guide, in the end, are going to get so powerful that politicians are going to have to either go that way or the other way. And they'll all be put under the hot seat, Labour and Country Party and all the rest. But yes, let's go for independence. I think so.
Jeremy, do you think that withdrawing the invitation to Campbell might in fact assist him in his... with the Hanson question?
No, I personally don't. But it might make life easier for him.
That's what I meant.
I think it was a gesture from the League. Look, we understand that we are being used as an instrument to hit you over the head. And if it would make life easier for you not to come, we accept that graciously. And I think it was a pretty gracious gesture that Betty made, really. I don't know what Campbell will do. I mean, he might well say, well, what are you turning me down? I want to be there. I don't know what he'll say. But he might... he's obviously feeling the heat. Yep.
Jeremy, we saw when
unexpectedly, a lot of One Nation people were swept into office in Queensland. Suddenly they fell apart. Shouldn't we be running seminars in competency and training people who will know how to function when they're elected as independents? Surely we should be running these practical, hard work, workshop type things and getting people who will be trained to do a job, an honest job, when they get elected.
Yes, I agree with that. One of the things, I can only speak briefly on this because it's still got a way to go, but I think there will be an official announcement made at the next Inverell Forum. I've been working over the last 9 months with a group of other people, all respected people, on a concept of building. It's going to be a cooperative that's going to be registered in New South Wales, but one of its prime tasks is going to be to go back and produce a course of civics. And this is going to be offered. Why vote for anybody who hasn't demonstrated they understand our system? And it will offer a certificate that can be available to everybody, whether you're going to stand for Parliament or whether you just want to do it as an ordinary citizen. And it's going to offer some of the things that Graham was talking about, a wealth of wider literature and some other investment concepts that we're trying to develop. But it's got to be registered, first of all, and that takes time, and then we've got to work out a business plan for the thing and a whole lot of other things. But we've got some top people involved, and it may be that some of the dreams that Graham Strawn was talking about, and I'm very keen to get together with him, can be taken a step further. So, yes, I agree with that. We've got to have a benchmark. Whatever party it is or whatever independent it is, at least should have demonstrated. They've read the Constitution. I was rung up by a young guy standing for One Nation from Charters Towers. Burning, you know, he's going to save the nation. What should I do? And I said, well, have you read the Constitution? He wasn't even sure we had one. Well, how the hell can he stand for Parliament? I mean, enthusiasm is one thing, but you've got to have some basic knowledge about how our system works and what we stand for. And, you know, unless the people in each area are prepared to demand some standards. Every National Party bloke ought to do that, and every Liberal, and every Labour. And there's some history about the place. They're all, most of them are bums, I think, if you excuse the expression. Yes, John?
I've only got two things. One thing is on observations that I've made going through supermarkets. I've noticed now there's been a tremendous increase in the labelling there. Even though they're not Dick Smith's or Ausbuy things, everybody is putting now Australian owned and made now on their labels, tin cans, you know, cans of fruit, that sort of thing. Well, that's one thing. Now, the other thing is about the coalition have accused the ALP of going to raise taxes, because they made some blue there. Well, the ready source of that, of course, could come from the multinationals who don't pay enough tax in this tax anyway. They're not going to do it. So it depends on the independents and the minor parties to push that forward there. Now, will they do it? Multinationals, tax the multinationals. Will they ever do it? Are they frightened of it?
I can't answer that. There's no such thing as a member of parliament you can trust until they have already got in there and demonstrated what they're worth. I've seen top people go into politics determined to solve the problem, and you thought they were men of integrity, and they'd wilted in 6 months. The heat was too great, the pressure was too great. So the test is not before the election, the test is after the election. But at least they got a head start. They haven't sold their souls in order to get into office. I mean, every party hack now has to sign a document saying, I'll do what I'm told by the party whip. I would have thought that was thoroughly anti-Christian and probably illegal. So the independents have got a head start. But let's get a few in there and try and see what happens. But I'll tell you, every independent is going to find it too big unless he's got some healthy support in his own area can sustain him and his family. Because the heat's going to go on him once he gets in there. But who knows, John? None of us know what's going to happen. Except that in the end, I think it is the awakening amongst the people that is even more important than getting a few decent politicians in. If there is a huge movement wants something in Australia, it still has the power to get it. It still has the power to say we're not having an ID card. It still has the power to say we're not having that wretched investment thing, the MAI. And politicians say, if this is big enough, we'll back off. And I think that's important. We've got to muster non-party force on issues, and we've got to give that direction, and we've got to find the issues that really motivate people. And there's a lot of steam left in the Australians. We've got to get, and I'm sorry to say, women are better than this at men. Women are very powerful. The great trick is to point them in the right direction before you pull the trigger. But and it takes men to do that, of course.
There's only one other thing I mention, and that is about the BHP-Billiton merger. Now, Costello hasn't said anything about it. He has to rely on the FIRB, which in turn, of course, is dictated to by the Treasury. Now, I don't know what they're going to do. Do you think he's going to hold over until after the election?
No. I think BHP was a multinational before this deal even came through.
So it'll go through then.
And I think it is a coup de grace, and I think it is a takeover of BHP.
It is?
Yes. And they might have a token office in Melbourne to keep the pollies happy and the newspapers, but it's it'll be run from London.
No, but the fellow in Billiton said, we're going to have an office in Melbourne for the time being.
That yes,
was the, that
exactly.
was the words he used.
Ah, total farce. One more?
Thank you.
Jeremy, I feel that we've got to do something more than what we're doing. I think we've got to march on Canberra without any arms or anything, but march on Canberra to let them know just what is happening to the people in this country. Our multinationals are taking us over. I was at that demonstration in Brisbane on the milk one, and a chap asked, could he speak? And out of the crowd, and they let him speak. And he's got to pay some $100,000+ to get a license to fish. And the multinationals are waiting there. If he can't rake that dough up, bad luck, mate.
Yes.
We'll be lucky the way things are going if we get a bit of shark in the next few years. All the good stuff's going overseas. Our good fruit's got to go overseas. The top stone fruits, they all go overseas. The top pine, knotty pine out of our forest, that all goes over. All we get to build with is what, when I was a kid, they used to burn the bloody stuff. It was the sap. But I think we've got to do a little bit more. Our Ned Kellys are all joining forces. That's our four major banks. Senator Len Harris sent us a little bit of information the other day, and they seem to think that the four major banks are going to amalgamate. So what's that going to do to our Australian people? They're waiting on people on the downs, from what I can gather. If they'll give them money to plant and so forth, if things go good, they'll take them over. If they don't, it's much better to leave them there as a caretaker. But there's too many people being pushed and jammed around. I think we've got to stand up and be counted. And the only way to do it, I think, is a national march on Canberra, get a lot of buses and go down, and try and, I think it might shock a few people, but I think it's got to be done. Thank you.
Well, I agree that we've all got to do more. I don't go along with the marching bit. Having gone through all those marches organised by the National Farmers Federation at the end of the 80s, and having seen that huge march through Melbourne by Danny, whatever his name was, from Geelong Way, on the whole, politicians breathe a sigh of relief when they see a march coming, because they know that at the end of the day they'll have to get the police on, and they'll have to control the crowd, but at the end of the day, the people go home without achieving their objective, and the politicians just go on drinking coffee. Sometimes there is value if you can link that to a specific issue. I think the dairy demos were able to focus it on the dairy thing sufficiently for people, but even that didn't have a final solution. But I'll tell you what, it raised enough heat for the farmers, for the government to say we've got to have another handout for the dairy farmers. But I think we've got to go further than that. We've got to have some demonstrations of force. I think what Terry Rogers said today is very good. If you can pin one member of parliament down to the point they're more frightened of you than their party, you're getting somewhere. Quantum Research, which is the most important survey in Australia, way ahead of all the polls, they do an annual survey here in Australia, and by the time they've done it, they charge $20,000 for the survey, and they sell it to all the big banks and all the politicians and all the government departments and all the insurance companies, and that's the best marketing document they've got. These are the trends happening in Australia. And the latest one has just come out. None of us are ever going to see it because we haven't got $20,000, but they had a write-up in The Australian. And it said this: the Australians are more volatile now than ever before. They are going to turn and rend the major parties. But the biggest single issue in city and country alike is foreign ownership. And the multinationals are petrified. They don't know how to counter it. They have lost, just through Dick Smith alone, over $90 million worth of business. And now some of them are taking full-page ads. Look, we're trying to help the Australians. Kraft has been running full-page ads saying, we buy Australian peanuts. They don't tell you they send all their profits overseas, but they're really scared stiff. How do you fight against a Buy Back Australia campaign? Now, the people who are running the Buy Back Australian campaigns that I've been in touch with say, we're going to steer right clear of party politics. We're not getting involved. We're going to bring everybody in, green, blue, red, left, Presbyterian, Catholic, the whole lot. We don't care. We have a simple message. Spend $50 out of your household budget on Australian made and we can wipe $20 billion off the foreign debt each year. And he said, people understand that. But he said, the day is coming, once we've got 150,000 or 200,000 members, we're just going to produce one sheet of paper. These are the politicians who want to buy back Australia, and these are the ones who don't care. You vote how you want. And he said, that'll be the most important and powerful document in the country, and it will be. We've got to get intelligence. Marches have a limited application in certain special situations, but most of them are a waste of money and are very demoralizing.
Jeremy, just in the electorates around here, how practical is it to get together, say, three groups of five to blitzkrieg an electorate?
They have a very good group here in Toowoomba already. Meets regularly, once a fortnight, isn't it, John? Yeah, once a fortnight. It can be done.
Well, we ran that pilot program, and I estimated it cost us about $300 in what we had to pay out for materials. Yeah. And well, personally, it cost me about 50 hours.
Yeah. I personally think the heat has gone out of the petrol thing until the next...
Oh, for sure.
Until the next price rise.
Yes, the concept.
But the concept is right.
Yes.
I think we've learnt your message, Terry.
We came to the conclusion that with three groups of five, if we had done it with three groups of five, we could have covered the whole electorate.
Yes.
And it's a large geographical electorate.
That's right.
Because of the people that come in behind it.
Yeah. That was a very important paper you gave today. Can we make this the last one?
It has to be the last question because we're over time.
The parallels that you drew, Jeremy, between conditions prevailing in ancient Greece and Rome and conditions prevailing today in Australia and Western Europe were absolutely spot on. Some of us may remember our Shakespeare and Julius Caesar and Mark Antony's speech, his funeral oration over the dead body of Caesar. He hath brought many captives home to Rome. Did this in Caesar seem ambitious? And it wasn't only Caesar, but it was military commanders before him and subsequently. In 70 AD, the Romans sacked the temple at Jerusalem, the second built. And from it, they took all the gold, all the ornaments, and Trajan, the emperor, he had a huge monument made, which you can see in Rome today. One of the carts, piled on top of the carts, is the great seven golden candlesticks looted from the temple. With all the money and the loot that they brought back from the many lands that they conquered, the Romans, along with local capitalists in Rome, went into the country of Italy and they forced out or bought out tens of thousands of little farmers. These were either intimidated out or bought out for knockdown prices, and they and their freemen, laborers, drifted off back to Rome. In their place, among these many Caesars, many prisoners brought back to Rome, the military commanders and the capitalists from Rome built huge barracks and they filled them with slaves from their conquered territories. Now slaves are unwilling workers and in due course food production fell. So the Romans sent colonists out to Libya, which at that time was a green and lush country, into certain areas which wouldn't comply with a Roman occupation. They sowed the fields with salt to make them barren, which has a parallel with the salt patches in Australia today, which
Absolutely.
Have become barren too because of bad management.
Do you have a question?
These people who were on, who were employed, they came from Libya, from Greece, from all parts of the conquered world, but they couldn't produce enough food, as I said. So they sent colonists out to Libya with droves of slaves to grow grain, to grow wheat. And every year, the mob in Rome of dispossessed farmers grew, and there's nothing more true than that the devil finds work for idle hands. They rioted from time to time, and they were accommodated into tenements up to 10 stories high, which sometimes caught fire and burnt down. More riots. The equivalent in those days of a welfare society was a handout of grain, which was performed once a month or once a fortnight in some places. And the Romans had a fleet of ships plying between Libya and Rome, and tensions mounted as the season for reaping the grain drew on. Would it be a good crop? Would there be storms to sink the ships? And in due course... Yes, well, okay. The question is that what we see happening in this country today and in Western Europe is an exact replica of what you were talking about earlier and what happened to them, because this produced the collapse of Rome in due course and the ruin of ancient Greece. This is exactly the prescription that is going to destroy Australia and Western civilization.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Thank you very much.